From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, yep, those open lines. Here's what's happening. President Barack Obama has said a surface-to-air missile fired from a rebel-held area in East Ukraine did indeed bring down the Malaysia Airlines flight MH17. The plane crashed on Thursday, killing all 298 people on board. And the U.S. and Russia clashed at the U.N. Security Council, with Russia's envoy putting the blame on Ukraine for its army's attacks on eastern areas. And listen to this. Now, you know how I read an email yesterday from someone who said, I wonder if this is that missing Malaysian 370 plane. They were both Boeing 777s. It's kind of weird, right? Listen to this story today. A top pro-Russia rebel commander in eastern Ukraine has given a bizarre version of events surrounding the Malaysian jetliner crash, suggesting that many of the victims may have died days before the plane took off. The pro-rebel website is called Russkaya Vesna, quoted Igor Gherkin as saying that he was told by people at the crash site that a significant number of the bodies weren't fresh, adding that he was told that they were drained of blood and reeked of decomposition. That's a strange story. Let's check in, though, with Jerry Corsi. We'll get his reaction to this situation. Jerry, of course, writes for WND.com and, of course, is a noted author, including his latest works, Hunting Hitler and Who Really Killed Kennedy. Jerry, this is another strange story.
It is, George, and it's probably going to get stranger before it gets resolved. I mean, first of all, President Obama undoubtedly has good intelligence. The NSA and other satellite capabilities, military and CIA, the United States has, we should have been able to have tracked that airplane and tracked whatever hit that airplane, including where it came from. So, you know, my first inclination would be to go with what President Obama is saying. It was and the rebels seem to have initially taken claim that this was shot at a cargo plane.
Yeah.
So, you know, my suspicion is that the pro-Russian separatists were not doing as well as Russia wanted, and Russia probably upped the ante by supplying the sophisticated surface-to-air missile system and even training and maybe helping operate the system. And now Russia's backtracking that the hit went on a airliner instead of a Ukrainian cargo plane.
Putin's got to be shaking his head, Jerry. He's probably the one who authorized these missiles to be given to these pro-rebels. And he's probably saying, you know what, had I not done that, this plane still would have been around.
I think so, George. And the adverse international reaction has got to put pressure on Russia and Putin. And I think most people in the world believe that Putin, ex-KGB, is more than capable of delivering this kind of a murderous system and allowing it to be used in possibly even an irresponsible way.
Indeed. Jerry, thanks. You have yourself a good week. We'll continue to watch that story unfold. Gaza's night skies were illuminated Friday by clashes between Israeli forces and Hamas militants throughout the 27-mile-long Palestinian territory. As Israeli tanks and soldiers plunged deeper into Gaza, the fighting against Hamas led to a high toll of casualties, doubling of displaced Palestinians, now to at least 40,000 people, prompting a United Nations relief agency to seek $60 million in help. The situation in Iraq: extremists occupying large parts of Iraq and Syria have now issued a threat to Iraqi Christians in the city of Mosul. Accept Islam, they say, or pay extra taxes to Islamic Sharia courts, or simply face death by the sword. Those are their ultimatums. Wow. California now, 80% of California is now in an extreme drought, according to new data, and they don't see an end in sight. It's about time for a intention experiment there. And talking about things in the sky, what's going on with you, Peter Davenport, from the National UFO Reporting Center?
For having me on tonight. You know, it used to be the case when I came on radio programs talking about UFOs, it was the strangest story of the night on that program. But good heavens, that's no longer the case. There's nothing that could be stranger than the things going on this planet.
I know, real stories.
Yeah. Boy, it's bizarre. Well, I usually try to address two or three or four reports or sightings during one of these brief presentations, but I think I'm going to set that aside and talk about one very, very dramatic event that occurred last Saturday night, the 12th of July, the night of the first of three super full moons. Very dramatic sighting. You may even have reported on it already. But we received, starting about 9:10 p.m. Central Daylight Time, we started receiving the first of what proved to be many, about 80 reports of an incident that involved two white lights that appeared to be streaking from east to west. When I say streaking, I probably misused that term by using it too often, but for example, some of the witnesses indicated that two of these two white lights in tight formation streaked from east to west, from horizon to horizon, in between 2 and 3 seconds. Way, way too fast for them to have been meteors, and they're being reported as meteors by a lot of news media, by a lot of astronomers and planetariums and so on and so forth, but I don't think so. The gentleman who probably had the best view of all was a pilot flying for a major airline. He was flying from Chicago down to Dallas-Fort Worth. They were about 60 miles north of Fort Smith, Arkansas. He saw the whole thing in his front window. It was about 20 degrees up above his horizontal plane. They were at 32,000 feet. He watched the object. Initially, it was one object, split into two, change color, go off into different trajectories, and then just suddenly disappear from his sight. We took reports from South Carolina, Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, Texas, and possibly California, and there's a possibility that the objects turned back east and followed their course going the other direction. Very, very interesting case. We should have all of those reports posted to our website sometime tomorrow. Tonight, a couple very interesting cases, one from Cape Natick, Maine. A couple was walking on a beach there. They saw four orange objects. I know I talk about them frequently. It's the most compelling aspect of ufology today. And they report that the objects went one direction down the beach and then turned around and went the other direction. And just 2 hours ago, something very similar from the east end of Long Island, Montauk Point, a couple saw a red light rise from the ocean and go streaking up into the sky. So I'll keep you up to date on what's going on.
Thanks, Peter. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. In just a moment, over the next couple hours, we're going to be talking about strange supernatural cases. Butch Witkowski's back with me on Coast to Coast, and he's next. Don't go away. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Butch Witkowski back with me. He was with me a couple of years ago. He's been an independent researcher since 1989, when along with four other people, he witnessed a UFO of unbelievable size quietly hovering above a mountain in Tucson, Arizona. It was 8 years before the Phoenix Lights. He moved slowly up and down, then it rose upwards and moved forwards, and it simply vanished at lightning speed. Calls to the sheriff's department, the media, the local Air Force base, no sighting reports. He began then his own investigation into the UFO phenomenon, and he continues doing that to this day. Butch, welcome back.
I'm glad you have me back. Thanks.
How have your 2 years gone in the meantime?
Yeah, I'm getting older.
We all are, Butch. The clock just doesn't stop, does it?
No, it doesn't stop.
My gosh. Where are you living these days? You're still out in that area?
I'm still in Pennsylvania.
Okay, good. Good. It's a great area. So what projects are you doing these days? Because you've still got the same website, right?
We have a newer website, just an easier to navigate website, euphorcop.com. We're still 5 years into the Todd Cease investigation. We're still working on abductions. We're publishing JAR magazine on the website, which was started by Elaine Douglas, I believe, in 2007, stopped in 2009.
Yeah.
And she was my director in Utah. And when she passed away, one of the promises I made, one of the things we were working on before she passed away, was that I would revamp it and put it back on the net. And we have done that. And her family has graciously donated all the files from her and her library to us and to Marilyn Carlson out in Oklahoma. We're going to have a separate website for that shortly, where all her files of her 28 plus years of UFO and abduction research are going to be on the net, available to everybody.
Great. Let's go through some of the cases you've been looking at, Butch, while we've got you tonight.
Sure.
The Todd Sees one. Now, he was abducted back in 2002, and subsequently he was murdered. This is a strange case. What do we know about it?
Well, strange is kind of a
understatement.
Really weird word for this, because it's beyond strange.
Yeah.
It has taken us, it took us almost 3 years to just get the autopsy report and the toxicology report. And just recently we went into the Social Security Death Index, because we can't find anything on this guy. I mean, there's no photographs, there's no record of him other than his birth and death, that he ever existed. So we went into the Social Security Death Index. And if you've ever been in that and looked up a family member, you'll see that there's the name, date of birth, date of death, father's name, mother's name, sometimes grandparents, what you did for a living, that you graduated or didn't graduate from high school or college, that you had siblings, that you had children. It's just a whole bunch of stuff. Under his, when we looked it up, which was just a few weeks ago, we looked it up, and it had his name, date of birth, date of death, and said no record of marriage or children. And that was it. That was it. That was completely it. Done. And I'm thinking, you know, somebody's really going to a lot of trouble to hide the information on this guy.
Well, what do you know about him? I mean, how'd you even get involved trying to track down this case?
Actually, I picked up on the case on the internet, and, you know, it was kind of...
It's a strange. Well,
it started with Peter Davenport. He was the original.
That's right.
He was the original investigator, and you know, a lot of his stuff. You know, I just started following up on, and I was hitting the same dead ends he was. And then we started making contacts through. We started a cold case unit, so I was using people that weren't known in ufology, and they started making inquiries as just people, you know, people, and with no connections to ufology. And people started talking, and we started getting more information. And, you know, the coroner refused, I believe, to talk to Peter Davenport. We got online with him, and he was telling us all about his foundation that he started. And, you know, my guy started making, you know, pretty decent contact with the guy. And pretty soon he just said, you know, hey, look, you know, I'm looking into this case. He said, how do I get a copy of the report? Well, the guy, well, that's not happening. Well, it did happen eventually. And the toxicology report.
Tell us what we do know about Todd Sees, about the abduction, and then the subsequent murder of this guy. What do we know about
him? Well, what we know is that there was a report of a sighting on the day of his disappearance of a large craft above a power line near his home, and a light shining down. Two fishermen in the river, which is kind of across the road from his home and down just a little bit, but goes all the way up through.
And the home being where?
Northumberland County, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And they see a light come down from this craft above the power lines, and they see something that looks like somebody being pulled up in their underwear and a T-shirt. Now, that was the report. But that report just sort of fell by the wayside, and, you know, it was kind of written off as, oh, yeah, okay, so that happened. And there were two farmers in the field, which is the farm right below his home, that said they saw the same thing. And again, the report was written off. We were in contact with the newspaper. The person was writing all the articles. They were very happy to give us all the information. The minute they found out who we were, not only did they stop giving us the information, all the stuff in the archives disappeared. So when we get the autopsy report and we find out how he's found, what he's wearing, he actually went out to do his pre-season deer spotting. He was wearing a camouflage jumpsuit. But he was found in socks, cut-off jeans, and a T-shirt, just like the two fishermen described being pulled up into the craft. So we got that information, and then, you know, we also had contact with family members. One family member said, when we were asking him about, well, you know, what did you ever go out and look for anything else after he was found? And they said, well, we did go out looking for his clothes. I have no idea why they would do that, but they found his coveralls. I'm imagining they were looking for the keys for his ATV. And they said they went through the pockets, and the pockets were clean. There was nothing there. Yet when, and then they turned him over to the police, and the police, during the autopsy, mentioned to the coroner and to the doctor performing the autopsy that there was cocaine found in the pocket. That makes no sense at all.
None.
I mean, if it was my brother, sister, uncle, cousin, I don't care. If I found it and there was something in that pocket, it'd be buried right there.
Yeah.
And when we questioned them about it, they just said they're lying. Okay, then we have, you know, from the time he's found till the time he shows up at the hospital for the autopsy, which in anybody's mind, you know, if somebody, if you're in an accident at 10 o'clock at night, by the next morning, you know, first of all, you're taken to the hospital, you're put in the refrigerator, and the next morning your post is done. He left the scene or was taken from the scene, and he doesn't arrive at the hospital till 14 hours later. We find out that the amount of degraded cocaine in his system during the autopsy, and checking with forensic doctors and pathologists, we talked to many. They all said the same thing. With that amount of degraded cocaine in his body, he would have fell over on the spot right after he took it. Not walked a mile from where his vehicle was found to being found on his own property, which was searched many times over by over 200 searchers, cadaver dogs, divers, a state police helicopter was up. And so when then the coroner puts the statement out that the guy was dead for 24 to 36 hours. Well, if that's a fact, then we have the first recorded case of an actual zombie.
Yeah, exactly, because people saw him after the fact.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So there are so many things that, and, that have been hidden but pop up eventually. And thus, so far, you know, like I said, we're into it 5 years. You know, we have our cold case unit, which is worked by Mike Recrue, and we have we work with Lon Strickler, Phantoms and Monsters, and his 40 research team. And I'll tell you, these guys are indispensable. They found out stuff that, you know, we just beat bushes and bushes for years until we got the information. And we're just going to keep digging until we get the answer.
No family has come forward? Nothing?
No. We've had FOIA requests sent back to us because of bad spelling. Do you believe that?
It's almost as if they don't want you to get involved with this.
Yeah. I've been told. I've been told not to. And,
have you been threatened, Butch?
Not threatened, just told something I shouldn't be looking into. But, you know, that was many years back when I said, you know, you shouldn't really drink that. That's going to make you sick. Not at least let her either.
The ingesting of the cocaine, do you think he did it? Or do you think somebody put it in him? Or do you think he didn't even have any in him in the first place?
Good question. So what happened during the 14 hours between when his body is picked up and when his autopsy is conducted? That and another fact that the condition of the body when it's found is unbelievable. I mean, this body is in the advanced stages of putrefaction.
Like it had been dead for days.
Yeah.
Maybe
he
was
only
a zombie.
Missing for 38.3 hours. But he was supposed to be, according to the coroner, dead for 24 to 36.
Yeah.
And when he's found under a tree, face up. And right now what we did was, or what we're doing, we're having a forensic artist. We're supplying the information from the report. And he's, you know, putting that onto paper. So now we have at least, because the coroner told us, you're never going to get a picture. You'll never see a picture. Nobody will ever see
it. I would guess, Butch, if you didn't get reports of people seeing him being lifted above into a vehicle or a craft of some type, you probably wouldn't even have dealt with the story, right?
Probably. But again, here we go. Within the last 3 months, we've had two reports along the same route, one within 7 miles of his house and the other even closer, of a craft above the river with a light shining down.
You mean at this point?
One from a person in a vehicle that was parked.
Current stories.
Current stories.
Oh, boy. They're looking for more people.
Well,
or something.
The amount of people that have been missing, I wouldn't, you know, they've been doing a really good job.
Well, I mean, see, that is a very bizarre situation that's happening all around the country, Butch.
Everywhere.
As you know.
Everywhere.
And let's get into that when we come back. Our special guest for the next couple hours, Butch Witkowski. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. As you know, we've talked with David Politis about people missing in our state parks, but this is all over the place. So we'll get more information from Butch when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And, of course, you're listening to Coast AM. Butch Witkowski with us, and I'm George Norrie. Butch, let's get into some of these disappearing cases. You know, we know many of them that have occurred in state and national parks where people go in and they simply don't come out. What are you hearing?
Well, it's just not the state parks. I mean, it's all over the place. I mean, they're you know, back in when I started looking into abductions in 08, you know, there were approximately 800,000 missing persons reports filed to the FBI every year. And I just updated that. So since 1991, there's almost 15 million people that have disappeared. Now, 95% are found, and about 75% are runaways under the age 18. You got 20% spousal abuse, murders, elderly, kidnappings, et cetera. But that number, 5% that are never found, has not changed but 2 to 2.5% since 2008 to 2012, which are the latest numbers available. So when you average it out, you're looking at between 40 and 47,000 people missing a year that are never found. No way, no trace, never located, no body, nothing, gone off the face of the earth. That's only the United States. So, you know, I'm sure Namibia doesn't track that stuff or South Africa or anybody else. So you take the whole world in, and you're talking about a lot of people are missing.
Well, you've got to rule out a serial killer or a series of serial killers, because I don't think they're killing that many people.
They couldn't get that many knives and guns.
No, I agree with you. So other theories, portals, they're falling through other dimensions. They're merely disappearing. Possible?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm not talking about people that one of the things that's not put into the National Crime Information Center, which is a report that's filed by every police department, sheriff's department, law enforcement agency in this country, is they do not count under the abduction scenario that they have listed for missing persons, anybody that has been found and has thought or chalked up as a possible murder or a cold case. These are strictly abductions, abductions where reports were made of somebody's missing and they're never found again. So where are they?
Yeah, where are they? Okay,
yeah.
What about Bigfoot?
You know, that whole thing right now, they got so many things going on with, you know, you've got half the Bigfoot group saying that it's interdimensional. You got another part of a group that's saying that it's
some creature.
Some creature, you know, like an ape that came from China or something, Gigantopithecus.
Yeah.
Then you got another group that's saying, no, no, it's just wild men, which the, you know, the native indigenous call them. And so they have their own little war going on right now, which is unfortunate, because I think if they all got together and put their heads together and kind of nailed down some of this stuff, it would be a lot better. But, you know, even with, like, just using Todd's case as just an example, you know, we've used everything at our disposal. We're using clairvoyance. We're using remote viewers in as far away as Australia. And I just want people to know that, you know, even though we've uncovered a lot of undisclosed information in the last 5 years about the incident, it's a continuing investigation, and any new investigation concerning this incident is welcome. They can either get a hold of me directly at UFOCop.com, or they can contact Lon Strickler, PhantomAndMonstersResearch.com. And it's an active case. We're putting everything we got into it. We have no backers, or, you know, so everything's coming out of our pocket. But it doesn't really matter, because we have gotten so much information in just the last year and a half that we know if we apply it to other cases, we may come up with some answers. And that's what we're going to try.
And I don't think you're going to give up.
No.
No. So what about then the UFO possibility? That all these missing people, some 40,000 people just in the U.S. alone, that they're being abducted either en masse or individually by a series of UFO races.
It's very possible, George, because, you know, first of all, the thing that sets us back right off the get-go is that, you know, there is no repository for abduction reports in the United States. I mean, there are a lot of groups that help people that have been abducted.
Right.
And you know, we advertise them in jars so people have a place they can go and people they can talk to. But so if we have to zero in on a case or a few cases and then backtrack to see if there were sighting reports in that area or if it's a hot spot of sighting reports, kind of like Pallades is doing with his missing persons. You know, we're looking at, you know, he's looking at an area and we're looking at reports and trying to pinpoint if, okay, so we have four or five people abducted in this small town in the last 10 years, and in that same small town in that 10-year period, there's been 30 sighting reports. Well, that's a pretty good indication that, you know, it may be something extraterrestrial, and then it goes to, you got people calling or sending emails saying, well, could it be the government? Well, sure it could, you know. I mean, it could be the government, it could be extraterrestrial, but all I know is that, you know, 45,000 people a year are missing.
Absolutely.
And that has been pretty solid since 2008.
Well, there was a case in the 1930s, Butch, in Canada, where a village, the entire village is gone.
Gone. Yeah.
I mean, they left food cooking.
Yeah.
I mean, something strange going on here.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, at first I kind of shied away from that. And as I've gone on through this over all these years, it is just, I just feel as though, you know, we're probably dealing with something that we think we know a lot about, but we really don't know anything about.
I try, Butch, this is just part of the things that I do, but I try to picture myself in the position of an individual who's involved in any kind of an episode like this, whether they be in this Malaysia plane or in a car that crashes. I you know, almost kind of want to remote view what they went through.
Mm-hmm.
I can only, I can't even imagine what some of these people that are lost, that are taken, are witnessing moments before they're gone. It's got to be sheer horror.
Oh yeah, you know, I mean, you're driving down a road, and like you said, and I've tried to put myself in that position a couple of times. You're driving down a road, and it's dark and, you know, a little bit of moonlight. Next thing you know, you got a bunch of individuals standing in front of your car. Your car shuts down. They're surrounding your car. They're not anything that you've ever seen before. What goes through that person's mind must be horrendous.
Oh. Or the whole craft or the whole car is beamed aboard or something like that.
And we have reports where, you know, reports from northeastern the United States that match identical to reports that we've seen from Japan. And I don't mean they're close. They're identical.
Oh, they're identical. It's everywhere.
I mean, it's identical. They're describing the beings as the same. They're describing the craft as the same. They're describing what happens to them as the same. They're describing everything almost verbatim from something that happened to Japan maybe 2 years ago to something that just took place in the Northeast a year and a half ago.
I would bet 1 million people a year are disappearing.
Oh, I'm sure.
Worldwide.
This is a very conservative number at 45,000.
Haunted doll case. Tell me about this one you worked on.
Oh, well, I'm a skeptical believer.
And,
you know,
and by the way,
I got to see for myself.
I know two haunted doll cases. There's Robert the Haunted Doll down in Florida,
mm-hmm.
and there's another one up in your neck of the woods of a little doll called Annabelle.
Yes.
Which is spookier than heck. Was yours?
You know, what I did was I had gone out on a paranormal case with a team one time, and it was kind of, I wanted the education. Because I never did it before. So after watching these people bumping each other in the dark with cameras for about 2 hours, and then they showed me where they saw ghosts and this, and I left, and I thought, wow, what a waste of time. So Ghost Hunters Incorporated, which is a group in Pennsylvania, Reading, Pennsylvania, they've incorporated in 1974, same people. They don't switch over like everybody seems to do. And I asked if they'd let me trot along as an observer on a case. So they had this case, and the original case was that the people moved into the house about 30 days prior. It was a new home to them. And the young girl was having thoughts of, there was somebody in her room at night. No harm came to her, but she was very frightened that there was somebody in that room at night. And in the parents' room, they have one of these three switch lights, you know, low, medium, high. Well, that would go on anytime it wanted to. It would just go on and shut off. And there was nobody touching it. The electric was checked. That was fine. So that's what they originally went for. Now, we get there, And I'm just an observer. I'm just watching what they're doing. They're very empathetic. They're talking to the people. They're getting the whole story. They walk us through the house, where these things are happening. And there's a little guy there. He's maybe 3, 4, 5 years old at the most. And he picks up this toy out of a box, a doll, and it's encased in one of these plastic cases, you know, the kind that you need a fire axe to get into.
Yeah, I've seen those.
Oh, yeah.
You have no idea how they seal the thing in the first place.
Oh, this thing was sealed. Huh. You couldn't have got into this with dynamite. Well, he brings it out, and he says to his father, he says, "What's this?" And he said, "Well, that was a Christmas present. We packed it because we knew we were moving, and we just didn't get it out for you, but we'll get it out later tomorrow." Okay? So the kid takes it, and he puts it on a rocking chair in the living room, facing the kitchen.
Don't like rocking chairs already.
Oh, no. I don't like them any more than Ouija boards. and he pushes the hand, and a little light comes on, a little heart in the middle of this doll, and she says about five things. Like, "Will you be my friend? Will you go out and play with me? Who are you? I love you." You know, that kind of stuff.
Cute little things.
Only five things.
Yeah, but cute little things.
Yeah, cute little thing. So he places it down. The family leaves, and the only family member there is the sister, who is sitting with me in the kitchen, and I've been relegated to the job of watching the monitor. Now, these guys have set up cameras in every room, infrared, movement devices, all kind. I mean, they're very well equipped, and I was very impressed. And I'm thinking, wow, this is really neat. I get to watch all this stuff on the monitor. And we're into it maybe an hour, hour and 15 minutes. And I hear this music. And the girl looks at me and she says, "The doll." Now, from where the doll is to the doorway where I can see the doll is two steps. And I two-stepped that. I was right there. The heart was on. It was flashing. And the doll says, "I see you," in a man's voice. Now, this kid's ready to book. I'm ready to take off, but I can't go anywhere because the girl got me by the belt, and she said, "You're going nowhere without me.
You're staying."
You're staying, exactly. So I get the other members, and I said, "If this is what happened," they laughed. They said, "So how are you believing this now?" I said, I really got to look into this." So we went over and checked the dial out. The box was never open. There's no transmitting wires. And then I see this little thing at the bottom that says, "Batteries not included."
Oh.
Now I'm really freaking. I need to go outside and light up a cigarette, quick. So we get out.
I go with you, and I don't smoke.
Yeah. So they're trying to talk me through that this is possible. I said, "Do you think anybody got this on all these recorders you got through the whole house? They got recorders everywhere." He said, "We'll check, and we'll let you know." So the next day, they did, and the recorder they had in the basement, which is right below that living room, you can hear the music go off. You can hear the one lady say to her husband, "What's that music?" And then you can hear the doll say, "I see you," in a girl's voice, in the same little girl's voice, not the male voice that we heard.
Yeah.
So now the light. So we're sitting there calming down. I'm kind of staring at this screen, hoping nothing else happens for the rest of the night and I can drive home and be safe. And the girl says, "I wish the damn light would go on." She no sooner said that, the light went on. The monitor in the room that they had, which I could see on the screen, flashed that there was movement in the room. I contacted the guy who was two rooms away, said the light just went on. And then it went low, medium, high, and stayed on high. And I'm like, this is nuts. So I wrote down the time, 10:47. And he goes in, checks the room, and he does a couple other things, checks the wall, you know, the plug and all stuff. He's hammering on the thing, trying to make it, you know, like vibration set it off and all that. Well, it doesn't work. It just went on by itself. So he comes down, he says, "What time did this go off?" And I said, 10:47. He says, "The movement in the room is registered at 10:47.
Wow.
Now, this guy, you know, I've seen some strange stuff in my time, but now I'm ready to really, you know, I'm beside myself. And I said, "You know what, guys? I have doubted a lot of things in the paranormal over the years only because of the stories.
Well, just you're a healthy skeptic.
And cryptozoology. I mean, they all have their stories.
Sure.
And after you hear about 5,000 of them, you just kind of get immune to them anymore. But this struck me. And I'm going like, there ain't no way. So the parents come home. It's now 2:00 in the morning, and they're relating what we found. And we're talking to the young girl, or they are, and they said about, you know, "Have you had any more occurrences?" And she says, "No, not really." And then the mother said, "Well, tell them why." evidently they were very close to the mother's mother, the grandmother to the child, and she left her a bunch of jewelry, like a whole jewelry box full of stuff, and she's wearing her necklace. And she says, well, ever since I put Grum's necklace on, nobody bothers me anymore. I don't have that feeling anymore. So when I got home, I started looking all this stuff up. And this is very common. I mean, you know, like jewelry, the dolls. There's a lot of cases on these dolls that talk and move across the room, move from one shelf to another overnight.
And I'm thinking,
like, you know, if I got a doll that moves from one shelf to the other overnight, it's going in the burn barrel.
Yeah.
And, you know, but it was a very strange, the house just felt strange to me the minute I walked into the place. I mean, it was just, like I knew somebody was there that shouldn't have been there, and I don't even know why I had that feeling.
Sounds like the Talkie Tina Twilight Zone episode, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. But that was very, very educational for me. I have gone out with them again. We went to an old furnace that was built back in the 1800s, and there was a after a little research, which amazed me also, because that house that they did up there in Minersville with the doll, they went back to when the house was built. They had, you know, the deed information, who lived there, how long they lived there, what the house sold for. They had all this information. I'm thinking, like, finally somebody's doing it the way they should, just like they should when they're doing a UFO case.
Right.
Get all the background information first before you jump into the conclusions. And I think they did it very well. I was very happy, and I went with them to this furnace, and they have a light, and I guess they put this light out in the middle of nowhere. Now, but some of the background was that there was a Lenape Indian and Iroquois war between the two tribes back in the 1800s, and a lot of the Lenape got pretty much slaughtered. And there's supposed to be an Indian burial ground on the same property, but away from the foundry. And they put this thing up there, and they start asking questions. And I'm looking at them, and I'm thinking, like, well, this is a bit overboard, where we're going to talk to a light. And the light is not lit. And they asked a bunch of questions. Nothing was happening. And, you know, I'm getting kind of bored. I'm getting thirsty. I'm tired. And it's the middle of the night, and the guy says, were you Lenape? If you were, make the light light. And that light lit up.
Jeez, there you go again.
And I'm going, like, that's it. Here I go. You know, and everybody's looking at me, and I'm going, like, I ain't moving. I'm just staying right here. And so they asked another question, something about the battle. Were you wounded in the battle? If you were, turn the light off. The light went off. Now, there's nobody near this light. There's nobody standing within 15 feet of this light. And it's a light, a battery-powered light. And, you know, I can see everybody's hands. There's no transmitter.
Yeah, nobody's playing around there.
Yeah, and I'm going, like, wow. And they asked some questions, and they didn't get answers on a lot of things, but they did get answers. And then one of the questions I had, just as an investigator, I said, well, how does this Indian spirit know what you're saying to them in modern English? And he said, you know, we've thought about that a lot. And he said, we kind of think that they can read your thoughts. You know, it's a mental process. And I'm going, like, well, you know, I hear that with people with abduction cases and with UFO cases too. And so it's a very strange genre. I think my two involvements as an observer scared me plenty. So
what is it about dolls, for example, though, Butch, that are scary?
I mean, they're freaky.
We never get a haunted doll that happens to be good. They're all evil.
Oh, and somebody was telling me, I think it was Dave Schrader I was talking to, and he said something about a lady turned into him. She just wanted rid of it, and she bought it at a yard sale or something. A clown doll.
Oh, the worst.
The most fearsome-looking clown doll that he ever saw.
Jagged teeth and everything else.
Oh, man, I'm going, like, I hope you destroyed it. He said, no, I really just wrapped it up and put it in my garage. I'm going, like, I wouldn't do that. I'm sorry.
Well, there's
no way. Going in my garage.
A few more cases I want to talk with you about sure. When we come back. But we're also going to take phone calls, Butch. And maybe our listeners can share stories with you if they have ever encountered a haunted doll, if they have anything like that.
That'd be great.
Oh, my gosh. I bet they're all over the place. And Butch's website, again, linked up for you. We make it really easy at coasttocoastam.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. That is easy as well. And download our free apps, if you would, for your iPhone or your Android by going to the store at coasttocoastam.com.